as they searched for a good hotel. Juliana kept glancing at the man beside her. With his hair short and blonde, and in his new clothes, he doesn't look like the same person, she thought. Do I like him better this way? It was hard to tell. And me, when I've been able to arrange for my hair being done, will be two different persons almost, created out of nothing, or rather out of money. But I just must get my hair done, she told herself. They found a large, stately hotel in downtown Denver with a uniformed doorman who arranged for the car to be parked. That was what she wanted, and a bellboy, actually a grown man but wearing the maroon uniform, came quickly and carried all their parcels and luggage, leaving them with nothing to do but climb the wide, carpeted steps under the awning, pass through the glass and mahogany doors, and into the lobby. Small shops on each side of the lobby, flower shop, gifts, candy, place to telegraph, desk to reserve plane flights, the bustle of guests at the desk and the elevators, the huge potted plants, and under their feet the carpeting, thick and soft. She could smell the hotel, the many people, the activity. Neon signs indicated in which direction the hotel restaurant, cocktail lounge, snack bar lay. She could barely take it all in as they crossed the lobby and at last reached the reservation desk. There was even a bookstore. While Joe signed the register, she excused herself and hurried over to the bookstore to see if they had the grasshopper. Yes, there it was, a bright stack of copies, in fact, with a display sign saying how popular and important it was, and of course that it was verboten in German-run regions. A smiling, middle-aged woman, very grandmotherly, waited on her. The book cost almost $4, which seemed to Juliana a great deal, but she paid for it with a Reichsbank note from her new purse and then skipped back to join Joe. Leading the way with their luggage, the bellboy conducted them to the elevator and then up to the second floor, along the corridor, silent and warm and carpeted, to their superb, breathtaking room. The bellboy unlocked the door for them, carried everything inside, adjusted the window and lights. Joe tipped him and he departed, shutting the door after him. All was unfolding exactly as she wanted. "How long will we stay in Denver?" she asked Joe, who had begun opening packages on the bed. "Before we go on up to Cheyenne?" He did not answer. He had become involved in the contents of his suitcase. "One day or two?" she asked as she took off her new coat. "Do you think we could stay three?" Lifting his head, Joe answered, "We're going on tonight." At first she did not understand, and when she did, she could not believe him. She stared at him, and he stared back with a grim, almost taunting expression, his face constricted with enormous tension, more than she had seen in any human in her life before. He did not move. He seemed paralyzed there, with his hands full of his own clothing from the suitcase, his body bent. "After we eat," he added. She could not think of anything to say. "So wear that blue dress that costs so much," he said. "The one you like, the really good one, you understand?" Now he began unbuttoning his shirt. "I'm going to shave and take a good hot shower." His voice had a mechanical quality, as if he were speaking from miles away through some sort of instrument. Turning, he walked toward the bathroom with stiff, jerky steps. With difficulty, she managed to say, "It's too late tonight." "No. We'll be through dinner around 5:30, 6 at the latest. We can get up to Cheyenne in 2, 2.5 hours. That's only 8:30, say 9 at the latest. We can phone from here. Tell Abinson we're coming. Explain the situation. That'll make an impression, a long-distance call. Say this. We're flying to the West Coast. We're in Denver only tonight, but we're so enthusiastic about his book, we're going to drive up to Cheyenne and drive back again tonight, just for a chance to..." She broke in. "Why?" Tears began to surge up into her eyes, and she found herself doubling up her fists with the thumbs inside, as she had done as a child. She felt her jaw wobble, and when she spoke, her voice could hardly be heard. "I don't want to go and see him tonight. I'm not going. I don't want to at all, even tomorrow. I just want to see the sights here, like you promised me." And as she spoke, The dread once more reappeared and settled on her chest, the peculiar blind panic that had scarcely gone away, even in the brightest of moments with him. It rose to the top and commanded her. She felt it quivering in her face, shining out so that he could easily take note of it. Joe said, "We'll buzz up there, and then afterward, when we come back, we'll take in the sights here." He spoke reasonably, and yet still with the stark deadness as if he were reciting. "No," she said. "Put on that blue dress." He rummaged around among the parcels until he found it in the largest box. He carefully removed the cord, got out the dress, laid it on the bed with precision. He did not hurry. "Okay? You'll be a knockout. Listen, we'll buy a bottle of high-priced scotch and take it along. That Vat 69. "Frank," she thought, "help me. I'm in something I don't understand." "It's much farther," she answered, "than you realize. I looked on the map. It'll be real late when we get there, more like 11 or past midnight." He said, "Put on the dress, or I'll kill you." Closing her eyes, she began to giggle. "My training," she thought. "It was true, after all. Now we'll see. Can he kill me, or can't I pinch a nerve in his back and cripple him for life? But he fought those British commandos. He's gone through this already many years ago." "I know you maybe can throw me," Joe said, "or maybe not." "Not throw you," she said. "Maim you permanently. I actually can. I lived out on the West Coast. The Japs taught me up in Seattle. You go on to Cheyenne if you want to, and leave me here. Don't try to force me. I'm scared of you, and I'll try." Her voice broke. "I'll try to get you so bad if you come at me." "Oh, come on, put on the goddamn dress. What's this all about? You must be nuts, talking like that about killing and maiming. Just because I want you to hop in the car after dinner and drive up to the Autobahn with me and see this fellow whose book you..." A knock at the door. Joe stalked to it and opened it. A uniformed boy in the corridor said, "Valet service, you inquired at the desk, sir." "Oh, yes," Joe said, striding to the bed. He gathered up the new white shirts which he had bought and carried them to the bellboy. "Can you get them back in half an hour?" "Just ironing out the folds," the boy said, examining them. "Not cleaning, yes, I'm sure they can, sir." As Joe shut the door, Juliana said, "How did you know a new white shirt can't be worn until it's pressed?" He said nothing. He shrugged. "I had forgotten," Juliana said, "and a woman ought to know. When you take them out of the cellophane, they're all wrinkled." "When I was younger, I used to dress up and go out a lot." "How did you know the hotel had valet service?" "I didn't know it." "Did you really have your hair cut and dyed? I think your hair always was blonde, and you were wearing a hairpiece. Isn't that so?" Again he shrugged. "You must be an SD man," she said, "posing as a WAP truck driver. You never fought in North Africa, did you? You're supposed to come up here to kill Abinson. Isn't that so? I know it is. I guess I'm pretty dumb." She felt dried up, withered. After an interval, Joe said, "Sure, I fought in North Africa. Maybe not with Pardee's artillery battery, with the Brandenburgers," he added. "Wehrmacht Kommando. Infiltrated British HQs. I don't see what difference it makes. We saw plenty of action, and I was at Cairo. I earned the medal and a battlefield citation. Corporal." "Is that fountain pen a weapon?" He did not answer. "A bomb," she realized suddenly, saying it aloud. "A booby-trap kind of bomb that's wired so it'll explode when someone touches it." "No," he said. "What you saw is a 2-watt transmitter and receiver, so I can keep in radio contact, in case there's a change of plan, what with the day-by-day political situation in Berlin." "You check in with them just before you do it, to be sure." He nodded. "You're not Italian. You're a German." "Swiss," she said. "My husband is a Jew. I don't care what your husband is. All I want is for you to put on that dress and fix yourself up so we can go to dinner. Fix your hair somehow. I wish you could have gotten to the hairdresser's. Possibly the hotel beauty salon is still open. You could do that while I wait for my shirts and take my shower. How are you going to kill him? Joe said, Please, put on the new dress, Juliana. I'll phone down and ask about the hairdresser. He walked over to the room phone. Why do you need me along? Darling, Joe said, we have a folder on Abenson, and it seems he is attracted to a certain type of dark, libidinous girl, a specific Middle Eastern or Mediterranean type. As he talked to the hotel people, Juliana went over to the bed and lay down. She shut her eyes and put her arm across her face. They do have a hairdresser, Joe said when he had hung up the phone. And she can take care of you right away. You go down to the salon. It's on the mezzanine. He handed her something. Opening her eyes, she saw that it was more Reichsbank notes. To pay her. She said, Let me lie here. Will you please? He regarded her with a look of acute curiosity and concern. Seattle is like San Francisco would have been, she said, if there had been no great fire. Real old wooden buildings and some brick ones, and hilly like SF. The Japs there go back to a long time before the war. They have a whole business section and houses, stores and everything, very old. It's a port. This little old Jap who taught me. I had gone up there with a merchant marine guy, and while I was there I started taking these lessons. Minoru Ichoyasu. He wore a vest and tie. He was as round as a yo-yo. He taught upstairs in a Jap office building and had that old-fashioned gold lettering on his door and a waiting room like a dentist's office with National Geographics. Bending over her, Joe took hold of her arm and lifted her to a sitting position. He supported her, propped her up. What's the matter? You act like you're sick. He peered into her face, searching her features. I'm dying, she said. It's just an anxiety attack. Don't you have them all the time? I can get you a sedative from the hotel pharmacy. What about phenobarbital? And we haven't eaten since 10 this morning. You'll be all right. When we get to Abenson's, you don't have to do a thing. Only stand there with me. I'll do the talking. Just smile and be companionable with me and him. Stay with him and make conversation with him. So that he stays with us and doesn't go off somewhere. When he sees you, I'm certain he'll let us in, especially with that Italian dress cut as it is. I'd let you in myself if I were he. Let me go into the bathroom, she said. I'm sick, please. She struggled loose from him. I'm being sick, let me go. He let her go, and she made her way across the room and into the bathroom. She shut the door behind her. I can do it, she thought. She snapped the light on. It dazzled her. She squinted. I can find it. In the medicine cabinet, a courtesy pack of razor blades, soap, toothpaste. She opened the fresh little pack of blades. Single edge, yes. Unwrapped the new greasy blue-black blade. Water ran in the shower. She stepped in. Good God, she had on her clothes. Ruined. Her dress clung, hair streaming. Horrified, she stumbled, half fell, groping her way out, water drizzling from her stockings. She began to cry. Joe found her standing by the bowl. She had taken her wet, ruined suit off. She stood naked, supporting herself on one arm, leaning and resting. Jesus Christ, she said to him when she realized he was there. I don't know what to do. My jersey suit is ruined. It's wool. She pointed. He turned to see the heap of sodden clothes. Very calmly, but his face was stricken, he said, Well, you weren't going to wear that anyhow. With a fluffy white hotel towel, he dried her off, led her from the bathroom back to the warm, carpeted main room. Put on your underwear. Get something on. I'll have the hairdresser come up here. She has to. That's all there is. Again, he picked up the phone and dialed. What did you get me in the way of pills? She asked, when he had finished phoning. I forgot. I'll call down to the pharmacy. No, wait. I have something. Nembutal or some damn thing. Hurrying to his suitcase, he began rummaging. When he held out two yellow capsules to her, she said, "Will they destroy me?" She accepted them clumsily.
"What?"
he said, his face twitching. "Rot my lower body," she thought. "Groin to dry." "I mean," she said cautiously, "weaken my concentration?" "No, it's some AG chemie product they give back home. I use them when I can't sleep. I'll get you a glass of water." He ran off. "Blade," she thought. "I swallowed it. Now cuts my loins forever. Punishment. Married to a Jew and shacking up with a Gestapo assassin." She felt tears again in her eyes, boiling. "For all I have committed. Wrecked." "Let's go," she said, rising to her feet. "The hairdresser."
"You're not dressed."
He led her, sat her down, tried to get her underpants onto her without success.
"I have to get your hair fixed," he said in a despairing voice. "Where is that whore, that woman?"
She said, speaking slowly and painstakingly, "Hair creates bear who removes spots in nakedness. Hiding, no hide to be hung with a hook. The hook from God. Hair, here, whore. Pills eating, probably turpentine acid. They all met, decided dangerous, most corrosive solvent to eat me forever." Staring down at her, Joe blanched. "Must read into me," she thought. "Reads my mind with his machine, although I can't find it." "Those pills," she said, "confuse and bewilder." He said, "You didn't take them." He pointed to her clenched fist. She discovered that she still had them there. "You're mentally ill," he said. He had become heavy, slow, like some inert mass. "You're very sick. We can't go."
"No, doctor," she said. "I'll be okay."
She tried to smile. She watched his face to see if she had. Reflection from his brain caught my thoughts in rots.
"I can't take you to the Abinsons," he said. "Not now, anyway. Tomorrow, maybe you'll be better. We'll try tomorrow. We have to."
"May I go to the bathroom again?"
He nodded, his face working, barely hearing her. So she returned to the bathroom. Again she shut the door. In the cabinet, another blade, which she took in her right hand. She came out once more.
"Bye-bye," she said.
As she opened the corridor door, he exclaimed, grabbed wildly at her.
"Whisk!" "It is awful," she said. "They violate. I ought to know. Ready for Purse Snatcher, the various night prowlers I can certainly handle. Where had this one gone? Slapping his neck. Doing a dance."
"Let me by," she said. "Don't bar my way unless you want a lesson, however, only women." Holding the blade up, she went on opening the door. Joe sat on the floor, hands pressed to the side of his throat. Sunburn posture. "Goodbye," she said, and shut the door behind her. The warm, carpeted corridor. A woman in a white smock, humming or singing, wheeled a cart along, head down. Gawked at door numbers, arrived in front of Juliana. The woman lifted her head, and her eyes popped, and her mouth fell.
"Oh, sweetie," she said, "you really are tight. You need a lot more than a hairdresser. You go right back inside your room and get your clothes on, before they throw you out of this hotel. My good Lord!"
She opened the door behind Juliana.
"Have your man sober you up. I'll have room service send up hot coffee. Please now get into your room."
Pushing Juliana back into the room, the woman slammed the door after her, and the sound of her cart diminished.
"Hairdresser lady,"
Juliana realized. Looking down, she saw that she did have nothing on. The woman had been correct.
"Joe," she said, "they won't let me."
She found the bed, found her suitcase, opened it, spilled out clothes, underwear, then blouse and skirt, pair of low-heeled shoes.
"Made me come back," she said.
Finding a comb, she rapidly combed her hair, then brushed it.
What an experience! That woman was right outside, about to knock.
Rising, she went to find the mirror. "Is this better?" Mirror in the closet door. Turning, she surveyed herself, twisting, standing on tiptoe.
"I'm so embarrassed," she said, glancing around for him. "I hardly know what I'm doing. You must have given me something. Whatever it was, it just made me sick instead of helping me."
Still sitting on the floor, clasping the side of his neck, Joe said,
"Listen, you're very good. You cut my aorta, artery in my neck."
Giggling, she clapped her hand to her mouth.
"Oh, God, you're such a freak. I mean, you get words all wrong. The aorta's in your chest. You mean the carotid."
"If I let go," he said, "I'll bleed out in 2 minutes. You know that. So get me some kind of help. Get a doctor or an ambulance. You understand me? Did you mean to?"
"Evidently."
"Okay. You'll call or go get someone?"
After pondering, she said,
"I meant to."
"Well," he said, "anyhow, get them for me, for my sake."
"Go yourself."
"I don't have it completely closed."
Blood had seeped through his fingers, she saw, down his wrist, pool on the floor.
"I don't dare move. I have to stay here."
She put on her new coat, closed her new handmade leather purse, picked up her suitcase and as many of the parcels which were hers as she could manage. In particular, she made sure she took the big box and the blue Italian dress tucked carefully in it. As she opened the corridor door, she looked back at him.
"Maybe I can tell them at the desk," she said.
"Downstairs."
"Yes,"
he said.
"All right," she said. "I'll tell them. Don't look for me back at the apartment in Cannon City, because I'm not going back there. And I have most of those Reichsbank notes, so I'm in good shape in spite of everything. Goodbye. I'm sorry."
She shut the door and hurried along the hall as fast as she could manage, lugging the suitcase and parcels. At the elevator, an elderly, well-dressed businessman and his wife helped her. They took the parcels for her, and downstairs in the lobby they gave them to a bellboy for her.
"Thank you,"
Juliana said to them. After the bellboy had carried her suitcase and parcels across the lobby and out onto the front sidewalk, she found a hotel employee who could explain to her how to get back her car. Soon she was standing in the cold concrete garage beneath the hotel, waiting while the attendant brought the Studebaker around. In her purse, she found all kinds of change. She tipped the attendant, and the next she knew she was driving up a yellow-lit ramp and onto the dark street with its headlights, cars, advertising neon signs. The uniformed doorman of the hotel personally loaded her luggage and parcels into the trunk for her, smiling with such hearty encouragement that she gave him an enormous tip before she drove away. No one tried to stop her, and that amazed her. They did not even raise an eyebrow. "I guess they know he'll pay," she decided. "Or maybe he already did when he registered for us." While she waited with other cars for a streetlight to change, she remembered that she had not told them at the desk about Joe sitting on the floor of the room needing the doctor. Still waiting up there. Waiting from now on until the end of the world, or until the cleaning women showed up tomorrow sometime. "I better go back," she decided. "Or telephone. Stop at a payphone booth." It's so silly, she thought, as she drove along, searching for a place to park and telephone. Who would have thought an hour ago?
when we signed in, when we shopped. We almost went on, got dressed up, and went out to dinner. We might even have gotten out to the nightclub. Again she had begun to cry, she discovered. Tears dripped from her nose, onto her blouse as she drove. Too bad I didn't consult the oracle. It would have known and warned me. Why didn't I? Any time I could have asked, any place along the trip, or even before we left. She began to moan involuntarily. The noise, a howling she had never heard issue out of her before, horrified her. But she could not suppress it, even though she clamped her teeth together, a ghastly chanting, singing, wailing, rising up through her nose. When she had parked, she sat with the motor running, shivering, hands in her coat pockets. "Christ," she said to herself miserably. "Well, I guess that's the sort of thing that happens." She got out of the car and dragged her suitcase from the trunk. In the back seat, she opened it and dug around among the clothes and shoes until she had hold of the two black volumes of the Oracle. There, in the back seat of the car, with the motor running, she began tossing three RMS dimes, using the glare of a department store window to see by. "What'll I do?" she asked it. "Tell me what to do, please." Hexagram 42. Increase. With moving lines in the second, third, fourth, and top places, therefore changing to hexagram 43, breakthrough. She scanned the text ravenously, catching up the successive stages of meaning in her mind, gathering it and comprehending. Jesus. It depicted the situation exactly, a miracle once more. All that had happened, there, before her eyes, blueprint, schematic. It furthers one to undertake something. It furthers one to cross the great water. Trip. To go and do something important, not stay here. Now the lines, her lips moved, seeking. 10 pairs of tortoises cannot oppose him. Constant perseverance brings good fortune. The king presents him before God. Now 6 in the third, reading, she became dizzy. One is enriched through unfortunate events. No blame if you are sincere and walk in the middle and report with a seal to the prince. The prince. It meant Abinson. The seal, the new copy of his book. Unfortunate events, the oracle knew what had happened to her, the dreadfulness with Joe or whatever he was. She read 6 in the fourth place. If you walk in the middle and report to the prince, he will follow. I must go there, she realized. Even if Joe comes after me, she devoured the last moving line, 9 at the top. He brings increase to no one. Indeed, someone even strikes him. He does not keep his heart constantly steady. Misfortune. Oh, God, she thought. It means the killer. The Gestapo people. It's telling me that Joe or someone like him, someone else, will get there and kill Abinson. Quickly, she turned to hexagram 43, the judgment. One must resolutely make the matter known at the court of the king. It must be announced truthfully. Danger. It is necessary to notify one's own city. It does not further to resort to arms. It furthers one to undertake something. So it's no use to go back to the hotel and make sure about him. It's hopeless. Because there will be others sent out. Again, the oracle says, even more emphatically, get up to Cheyenne and warn Abinson, however dangerous it is to me, I must bring him the truth. She shut the volume. Getting back behind the wheel of the car, she backed out into traffic. In a short time, she had found her way out of downtown Denver and onto the main Autobahn going north. She drove as fast as the car would go.
the engine making a strange, throbbing noise that shook the wheel and the seat and made everything in the glove compartment rattle. "Thank God for Dr. Tote and his autobahns," she said to herself, as she hurtled along through the darkness, seeing only her own headlights and the lines marking the lanes. At 10 o'clock that night, because of tire trouble, she had still not reached Cheyenne, so there was nothing to do but pull off the road and search for a place to spend the night. An Autobahn exit sign ahead of her read, "Greeley, 5 miles." "I'll start out again tomorrow morning," she told herself as she drove slowly along the main street of Greeley a few minutes later. She saw several motels with vacancy signs lit, so there was no problem. "What I must do," she decided, "is call Evanson tonight and say I'm coming." When she had parked, she got wearily from the car, relieved to be able to stretch her legs. All day on the road from 8 in the morning on, an all-night drugstore could be made out not far down the sidewalk. Hands in the pockets of her coat, she walked that way, and soon she was shut up in the privacy of the phone booth, asking the operator for Cheyenne information. Their phone, thank God, was listed. She put in the quarters, and the operator rang. "Hello?" a woman's voice sounded presently, a vigorous, rather pleasant younger woman's voice, a woman no doubt about her own age. "Mrs. Evanson," Juliana said, "may I talk to Mr. Evanson?" "Who is this, please?" Juliana said, "I read his book, and I drove all day up from Cannon City, Colorado. I'm in Greeley now. I thought I could make it to your place tonight, but I can't, so I want to know if I can see him sometime tomorrow." After a pause, Mrs. Evanson said in a still pleasant voice, "Yes, it's too late now. We go to bed quite early. Was there any special reason why you wanted to see my husband? He's working very hard right now." "I wanted to speak to him," she said. Her own voice in her ears sounded drab and wooden. She stared at the wall of the booth, unable to find anything further to say. Her body ached, and her mouth felt dry and full of foul tastes. Beyond the phone booth, she could see the druggist at the soda counter serving milkshakes to 4 teenagers. She longed to be there. She scarcely paid attention as Mrs. Evanson answered. She longed for some fresh, cold drink and something like a chicken salad sandwich to go with it. "Hawthorne works erratically," Mrs. Evanson was saying in her merry, brisk voice. "If you drive up here tomorrow, I can't promise you anything, because he might be involved all day long. But if you understand that before you make the trip—" "Yes," she broke in. "I know he'll be glad to chat with you for a few minutes if he can," Mrs. Evanson continued. "But please don't be disappointed if by chance he can't break off long enough to talk to you or even see you." "We read his book and liked it," Juliana said. "I have it with me."
"I see," Mrs. Evanson said good-naturedly.
"We stopped off at Denver and shopped, so we lost a lot of time." "No," she thought, "it's all changed, all different."
"Listen," she said, "the Oracle told me to come to Cheyenne."
"Oh, my," Mrs. Evanson said, sounding as if she knew about the Oracle and yet not taking the situation seriously. "I'll give you the lines." She had brought the Oracle with her into the phone booth. Propping the volumes up on the shelf beneath the phone, she laboriously turned the pages. "Just a second." She located the page and read first the judgment and then the lines to Mrs. Evanson. When she got to the 9 at the top, the line about someone striking him and misfortune, she heard Mrs. Evanson exclaim.
"Pardon?" Juliana said, pausing.
"Go ahead," Mrs. Evanson said. Her tone, Juliana thought, had a more alert, sharpened quality now. After Juliana had read the judgment of the 43rd hexagram with the word danger in it, there was silence. Mrs. Evanson said nothing, and Juliana said nothing.
"Well, we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow, then," Mrs. Evanson said finally. "And would you give me your name, please?"
"Juliana Frink," she said.
"Thank you very much, Mrs. Evanson."
The operator, now, had broken in to clamor about the time being up, so Juliana hung up the phone, collected her purse and the volumes of the Oracle, left the phone booth, and walked over to the drugstore fountain. After she had ordered a sandwich and a Coke, and was sitting smoking a cigarette and resting, she realized with a rush of unbelieving horror that she had said nothing to Mrs. Evanson about the Gestapo man or the SD man or whatever he was, that Joe Cinadella she had left in the hotel room in Denver. She simply could not believe it. "I forgot," she said to herself. "It dropped completely out of my mind. How could that be? I must be nuts. I must be terribly sick and stupid and nuts." For a moment she fumbled with her purse, trying to find change for another call. "No," she decided as she started up from the stool. "I can't call them again tonight. I'll let it go. It's just too goddamn late. I'm tired, and they're probably asleep by now." She ate her chicken salad sandwich, drank her Coke, and then she drove to the nearest motel, rented a room, and crept tremblingly into bed.
This ends side two of cassette 6 of The Man in the High Castle. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 7.